Going to head over to the phone line where we've got Mr. Joe Sinnott in a minute. That's how I remember how to pronounce the last name. Joe Sinnott with Whitting Partners. How are you doing today, sir?
Doing excellent, Jason. How about yourself?
Not too bad. I pronounced your last name correct, didn't I?
You did.
See how I remembered it?
Hey, a good mnemonic goes a long way in life.
That's right. I won't make that mistake five times in a row, but that's okay. We finally get to it. How you doing, by the way, out there in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area? You're not in Pittsburgh, are you? You're in the suburb of Washington, aren't you?
I am not as far as the Washington suburb. I'm only about 6 miles as the crow flies outside of downtown. So got myself a Pittsburgh mailing address, but we are not in the city limits of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I see. Washington is where I did a magazine back in my former life, and I know we had a conversation about that at one point and that you were outside of the Pittsburgh area, but also you're in Pittsburgh, which, of course, the Marcellus, the Utica. Is there any other shale plays out there that I'm thinking of off the top of my head?
Those are the biggies. That's the bulk of our production up here these days.
That's what I thought. So anything to update before we get into the Velvet Glove leadership?
Oh, we got a lot of continuing conversations about air quality in this neck of the woods. So,
okay.
Not too much of an update, but we got some stuff floating around. First is whether or not the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania will join RGGI, it's called, RGGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. So it's a bit of a political hot potato here where our governor wants us to be joining up with 10 other states that are not exactly the same in terms of politics as Pennsylvania, and our legislature is saying, yeah, not so fast. Not sure that that makes the most sense and that there's actually benefits. And then the other big thing from an air quality standpoint that came out this week is that a local group here, an industry group, released a report basically saying, hey, look, Pittsburgh's air is getting better and better. We shouldn't rest on our laurels, but, you know, thanks in large part to natural gas, our air around here is cleaner than it's been in decades. So that's probably the biggest story around here is the air we breathe and the fact that it is getting better and better.
Who's this RGGI now?
RGGI is I don't know what you want to call it. It's a group of states. So I think there's 10 or 11 states, or
okay.
I think Pennsylvania might be the 11th. But again, those states are, I think, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, if I'm not mistaken, maybe Rhode Island. So again, states that are, you know, different from a political standpoint, different in terms of the fact that, you know, they're not producing their own energy, but yet our governor here, Governor Wolf, wants us to join that.
Clearly
our voters here in Pittsburgh or in Pennsylvania, obviously, the whole state here, Pittsburgh as a whole is, you know, we don't vote for the same types of things that those other states do. So why should the governor unilaterally be making a decision for us to join? Shouldn't this be something that the state legislature has us join? And so that's kind of been, some back and forth there on whether the governor is able to do that or not, whether it's constitutional. And it is unsettled on whether or not the state will be joining RGGI, RGGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, sometime early next year.
Regional
Greenhouse Gas Initiative, RGGI. So it seems like we're missing an extra vowel there to actually call it RGGI, but that is what the locals here have been doing to personify RGGI. And to personify RGGI as someone who, quite frankly, doesn't belong and who's going to be coming to our Commonwealth here and basically introducing a carbon tax, Jason. That's basically what it is. It is a carbon tax.
This is where I'm glad that you kind of went down that direction, because the reason I was kind of going question happy and pouncing on RGGI is, quite honestly, anytime a special interest group or a government agency names something, that's a big red flag for me. Huge red flag, because you're trying to humanize something that's not human. You're trying to personify something. You're trying to do what scientists say: don't name the bear, don't name the rat that you're about to dissect. You don't humanize something. Okay, so whenever the government wants to make sure that they get a road done, they name it. In North Dakota, Highway 85. Is they wanted to, it's out in the oil patch. They wanted to make sure it got funding and it goes down to South Dakota. Trust me, it's a very important road, not only for industry, but for tourism and travel and everything along those lines. So they named it the Theodore Roosevelt Highway. So when it comes to, you know, budget cuts, you're not cutting the budget from Highway 85. You're cutting it from Teddy Roosevelt. And so it's just kind of, you know, you're not saying no to the regional Grow Greenhouse Initiative. You're saying no to Reggie. You know, Reggie's that little boy that we all want to help. Come on, don't say no to Reggie. Look at Reggie. He's got freckles. Who's Reggie in Archie comic? Wasn't he a cartoon character too, Reggie? Anyway, but it's also a dog name. Reggie's a great name.
I think Reggie Miller, who was a nemesis or villain of the New York Knicks for years. So Reggie Miller of the Indiana Pacers. So again, you have a parallel there, maybe a reverse parallel, where you had this, you know, Midwestern representative from Indiana who was the nemesis of, you know, the East Coast, you know, big bad New Yorkers, whereas now Reggie represents the big bad East Coasters who are out there, you know, basically trying to take money away from us folks here in Pennsylvania. So
I see your point, but
I think Reggie Miller.
I'm sorry, but I got to step one step back and shoot a three-pointer in honor of Reggie Miller, because although he was a nemesis and he wasn't very well liked, he was accepted to the point where he actually got to do color commentary afterwards, and they brought his sister in, and she became one of the hottest things in all of sports entertainment. So although Reggie kind of on the surface seemed like a nemesis, like Reggie might seem, in the end they're going to bring him in to be part of our lives. That's what scares me about this stuff, because, you know, because I agree, Reggie Miller, he was kind of an asshole. He'd step on you in the court and everything else, but his name, Reggie, brought him to the next level. You see how powerful a name can be? So let's transition to that to Velvet Glove, because that's a great transition into the Velvet Glove. Before we got onto this, I don't know, I think we're probably into existential, if not ridiculous mode by now, at least existential, which is the 5,000-foot view of the 5,000-foot view. Velvet Glove, Joe and I actually kind of spliced it into a couple areas that I didn't even see coming, because for me, the Velvet Glove was always somebody who was, it was someone who, you know, the construction industry was a great example. Generally, it was a third generation, someone who's never picked up a hammer before, but they run the company. And so the first generation was the one that got the business going. So they did everything, all the way down to the accounting, pretty much. Second generation kind of did a little bit of the, you know, building the home still, but delegated the accounting, and basically they did the parts of the job that they liked to do, but did a lot of work, still hard work. Third generation, generally college educated, maybe even a master's in business, all kind, and, you know, comes right into the administration and really has never picked up a hammer before. You shake their hand and, oh man, what do they moisturize this thing every day? They not a callus on there. What do they got, velvet gloves on? So that's where that kind of came from. And a lot of times, you know, that was a legacy type of a business, type of a deal, you know, a generational type thing. But then it just kind of became, you know, hey, there are certain people that, you know, led a different lifestyle to where they never had to pick up a hammer. And then they ended up going to a college and, you know, getting a construction business management degree. And all of a sudden they're running a construction company and they've never picked up a hammer. And the guys building the homes kind of have a little resentment towards that leadership. And anyway, so what I'm saying is not, it's not a new topic, but Joe, you brought a whole new slice. A whole new finger. This might be the six-fingered man from Princess Bride here, what we're talking about. There's so many fingers of this glove. So you talk a little bit about the premise behind your velvet glove, and then we'll dive into a little bit in today's leadership.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, the other version of velvet glove, especially when it comes to leadership, is this idea of a velvet glove masking something underneath. So masking an iron fist, that's the most common kind of comparison there, right, is, you know, you can have a velvet glove, softer, often superficial niceness, if you will, but underneath, waiting for you or waiting for your stakeholders or your audience is this, again, this rougher iron fist, in some cases, you know, rough and tough bully kind of approach. So it's this, you know, kind of one extreme or the other, but all within 1 liter, all within one hand, if you will, which, again, obviously has some pros, but certainly has a lot of cons, too, which I'd be happy to dive into today with you, Jason.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because the first one, of course, let's parallel the oil and gas industry. And, of course, if anybody's listening from a different industry, this is applicable in every industry. However, the oil and gas industry is a legacy business. And I've heard this many times that so-and-so got a job because their dad worked for this company, or so-and-so worked for this company, and that sort of thing. So there is a little bit of that, you know, whether you call it cronyism or legacy or family business type of a thing. But that doesn't mean they're still not working their butt off, you know, especially out there in the oil field. You know, we're talking about is more the administration and more of the executive level. And I wonder how much of that is happening in oil and gas, where guys are coming in, girls are coming in, you know, maybe with a master's degree in business, but they've never actually set foot on the rig before. And that to me is a problem because of just being out of touch. You know, it's kind of like if you work in a restaurant, you should go wash dishes for a week. You should go cook for a week. Go serve for a week. I've always said, honestly, you shouldn't go eat at a restaurant unless you've worked in the service industry. And anyone who's ever worked in the service industry looks at me and says, yes, that should be a law. Because you totally appreciate and approach dining differently if you've been a server or cook before. So there's a little bit for you to unpack there about the whole legacy, the family run, the cronyism. However, in some industries, they still got to do the hard work. But from the administration side, I think some people look at that a little different when they haven't had any experience. But because of their last name, boom, velvet glove, there you go. Anyways, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, there's definitely a lot to unpack in that, Jason. But I think the common thread among all of the luggage that we can, you know, throw across the room here as we unpack this is that you want leaders, you want everybody, quite frankly, to be aware of how others are viewing them. You know, that doesn't mean you need to kowtow to, you know, people who think you're A, B, or C and adjust your behavior necessarily, but you want to be aware of it. So if you have a sizable portion of your employee base who's looking at you as someone who, you know, is entitled, if you will, or feels he or she is entitled to, you know, to be in a given role or, you know, again, just happen to be part of a crew or some clique or some family or whatever the case might be, at least if you're aware of how people are looking at you and how that view of you could be impacting your ability to lead, at least you could do something about it. So that's probably the first overarching thing, Jason, is, you know, why are we even talking about this? Well, because you want leaders who are conscious, they're aware, and they're aware of not only their own limitations, but importantly, you know, what does their audience think? How do they view them? Because I don't want to throw out random statistics, but let's just say 8 or 9 times out of 10, when I'm working with leaders who are facing some sort of barrier or have some sort of issue in front of them, it's because they were ignorant of it. It's because they were, you know, unconsciously going forward and they had no idea that people thought they were sounding like an idiot when they were in meetings or that they were making decisions that, you know, other people believed weren't thought out when they were. It's the same thing with this whole velvet glove situation. And, you know, whether or not we're talking about the velvet glove, you know, that you described, which is, again, sort of this almost this legacy person wound up in a position, maybe he or she shouldn't have been there, or whether we're talking about someone who is on the other end of the velvet glove where, you know, they're constantly flipping between being nice and happy and polite and, you know, a second later being a complete jerk. Regardless, if you have no sense that people are looking at you like that, well, then how the heck do you expect to avoid whatever problems can arise because they have lost confidence? So again, kind of a long-winded answer, and we can dive into some specific details.
Well,
but
no,
I do want to share that. There's a lot of stuff there, but the common theme is awareness. It's being conscious.
What surprises me about the velvet glove deal is, like I said, generally it was the third generation. Where I understood the velvet glove theory came out of was from a third generation, and again, construction, a builder, who, you know, never really even built a house before. First generation did everything. Second generation built the company, but still was a little bit hands-on. third generation, you know, the parents always want the best for their kids. So by the time, you know, the successful third generation came, they went to college and they never, you know, they worked at, you know, they worked at the grocery store. They worked at, you know, the sock hop place of the day, whatever it might be, you know, what's the modern day roller rink, whatever, you know, that type of thing. They let their kids be kids and grow up and have a good college experience. Well, now it's time to go into the real world. Now they're going to go work for their dad's trucking company, or they're going to go work for dad's real estate company or construction company or oil and gas company. But they've never worked in the deal. Tommy Boy, remember? That was the whole thing. That was the whole premise of Tommy Boy. He came in and he was going to take over. But you know what? That's okay, because that was a private company. I'm seeing it with now public companies and with, you know, government agencies, for example. I'll give you two examples right in my backyard. 20 years ago, 15 years ago, North Dakota State University, one of the top wrestling programs in the nation. Bucky Mon was the coach there for like 30 years, and he retired, right? So what do? They bring his kid in to coach. Well, his kid was an All-American, and sure, but his kid had never been a coach before. So, he checks all the boxes in terms of he's got the name, he's got good pedigree, he comes from this, but he'd never been a coach before. So, you know, at some point, somebody's got, and he only lasted a year, I think, and he was gone. And then in radio, where a radio station where I worked at, the guy who did the farm reports, he passed away. And so what did they do? They brought his kid in. And his kid had never worked in radio one day in his life. So instead of giving someone new an opportunity and go a new direction, it's almost like that sequel thing again, where we got to bring back Die Hard Part 6, Friday the 13th Part 9. We can't try a new thing. And so a little bit happened. I think there's almost like some of that spillover with the Velvet Glove as well, where I'm seeing that almost in other areas where only private companies you saw that before. Family businesses is where you saw that before. So am I kind of making sense a little bit as we peel this onion off, or did I make it more confusing?
No, you're making sense, and you're making it something that people can relate to with the Tommy Boy reference, because I think that that timeless classic there has actually been front and center in my mind over the last week or two, because one of my friends actually named his most recent son Callahan, as in Callahan Auto Parts. So there's been no shortage of Tommy Boy references floating around among my friends. But setting Tommy Boy aside for a second,
which is hard to do.
Which is hard to do, especially if we want to keep this podcast under 2 hours. But setting Tommy Boy aside for a second, forget that. Let's bring him back in. With Tommy Boy, yes, you had somebody that stepped in that clearly was not, you know, quote, qualified on paper. But the reality is he was put in that position. So he was put in a position to go and prove himself, if you will. And he brought something to the table that, you know, other people didn't have. He had a different personality, had a different approach, if you will. And in some ways, his ignorance ultimately led to, you could argue, some success for the company, right? And gave his company some advantages that maybe they wouldn't have had otherwise if he wasn't put in that position. So, but the key with that is, Jason, that he was in that position. So, for better or for worse, he was put in that position. Now the question is, how do you deal with it? And again, that's usually where I come in as a coach is, we're not looking to come in and just reinvent the wheel or just push somebody out of the way because it's not working out because he or she was put into this position, again, for whatever reason, family reasons or whatever the case might be. The question is, all right, this person's in position. How can we make the most of it? And how can we decide whether or not, it's sustainable? And that comes down, in my experience, with, to really two different, issues, but two common things you see with this Tommy Boy-esque Velvet Glove situation. And the first is imposter syndrome. And that's when you have somebody in position who knows he or she is maybe not qualified to be there and is now acting in a way that is kind of showing that, right? They're getting defensive. They're getting nervous. They're unable to make clear, confident, conscious decisions. And that, again, stems from imposter syndrome.
May I do a quick PSA?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
Okay. And then after the PSA, continue with the imposter syndrome. But I feel it is important to point out at this point, at this time, this is another topic that we've talked about is protecting the thought worker, protecting your intellectual property, because I've said this before in another podcast, and I believe it's been with you too, that right now there are a lot of people that are getting paid to bring new ideas to the boardroom, to the superiors, but they're actually paid yes men. They only know how to agree with their superiors and keep their job through low-hanging fruit. And right now, they're out there trying to pick your brain. Right now, they're trying to do a quick coffee call and just get some ideas from you and that sort of thing. The reason they're doing that is because they're actually getting paid by someone to do that. So they're not looking at doing business with you. They're not looking at paying you. They're looking at keeping their job. And that's who an imposter is. Continue, Joe Sinnott of Winning Partners. And if you disagree, please let me know if you disagree. But that's the way, that's what I see happening more and more, to where I felt the need to put in another PSA.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I agree because you actually landed on where you should be. And that is extracting really the, again, the uniqueness and the potential and the new ideas that come with someone who, quite frankly, doesn't fit the pedigree of somebody who should be in that position, who doesn't have the experience, who hasn't been in the trenches. And so, again, you have imposter syndrome, which we just said can lead to, you know, people basically just being in survival mode and trying to keep their jobs and saying yes and nodding their heads and being afraid to open their mouth because people realize how, you know, ignorant they are. Then you have the other side of the equation, which is people who are just so, you know, unaware of the fact that, you know, they're in this privileged position and they shouldn't be there. And again, they're going through life completely unaware. And in many cases, again, you know, continually losing credibility with people. That's not sustainable either. Where you want to be is in the middle, which is what you just, you know, kind of started getting us towards, which is someone who, yes, recognizes their limitations, recognizes that they might not have either the experience or the background, or in some cases, the education, whatever the case might be, but they do have something else they bring to the table. So again, you're talking about whatever word you use there, you know, thought leaders or creativity or creative minds, whatever. The idea is people can have different thought processes and different ways of thinking that can be useful. So for example, coming back to the oil and gas industry, it is very useful. And again, this is, I say this, the big old caveat, but it's useful to have people who have been in the field, who have worked for a service company, and who then migrate to an operator. That's the path that I was very lucky to have taken. You know, I spent 3 years offshore in a, you know, harsh environment, you know, dealing with all kinds of challenges and obstacles that come with being in that environment before I moved to an operator. I wouldn't trade it for anything, but at the same time, it's not practical to fill your entire organization with people who have gone through and worked in the trenches and done these things. I mean, it's just, it's, there's positives to it, but we need to recognize that, you know what? Some guy with some degree that has nothing to do with oil and gas, that's never stepped foot on a rig, that gets put into, you know, an operator role or reservoir engineer, whatever the case might be, he or she could make contributions that might be better than somebody that's been biased by being in the field. And again, I think the experience outweighs the bias, but at least if we can have an open conversation about the potential value and you recognize the limitations and you recognize the fact that, hey, you know, this ignorant person, for lack of a better word, can bring new ideas for the table, well, then again, you're going to be able to extract as much value as possible from that person. But the problem is, and again, I think this is a theme in a lot of what you and I have talked about over, you know, the last several iterations of this leadership series, Jason, is labels. We're so quick to label somebody as an outsider, as someone who's wearing velvet gloves because, again, they got the role for, you know, some dubious reason. We're quick to label somebody as an imposter, or we're quick to label somebody as a super genius, or we're quick to label somebody as a, you know, as a 20-year seasoned veteran who clearly is going to have ideas that are better than some, you know, Joe Schmo who, again, has never stepped foot on a rig. We're so quick to apply these labels. And at the end of the day, what happens? Well, people start adhering to these labels, you know, unwittingly, and we lose the ability to think clearly, and we lose the ability to ask good questions. And quite frankly, you know, we lose all of this intellectual firepower that these companies have. But it all comes back to, well, who's in charge? Who is, you know, who's looking at all of this? Do you actually have a leader who is, one, has enough self-awareness to know his or her limitations, but two, is confident enough and strong enough to, you know, call out times when, again, people are falling back on labels and titles and some of these false expectations instead of actually thinking clearly, thinking independently, and rallying people together to ask the questions that are needed to move a company forward instead of stagnating in some unsustainable manner.
Just thinking about all the obstacles Tommy Boy had to overcome, because I love the Tommy Boy velvet glove analogy, because actually that is true. What we're talking about is Tommy Boy, which is he'd never worked a day in his life in the brake pad. Is it brake pads or what was it? Yeah, in the brake pad plant, but he went to college and he went to college for 7 years and he got his degree, Herbie Hancock, the whole deal, man. And boom, he had a job waiting for him when he got back. And first of all, it took Michelle, a woman, to make him change and do some things, see life differently. So there he, you know, sat and was it the rowboat by himself?
Yep, sitting in his dinghy, waiting on some wind.
Yep, sitting in the dinghy, right? And then his dad died, so he had to do some major interpersonal reflection there. To where, of course, this is still probably one of my favorite moments in all of movies of all time, where he's sitting there on the park bench. Michelle left him. His dad died. The company's going under. One complaint after another. Then the park bench breaks. Could have done without that. That's just like the best thing ever. So unfortunately for some of you people out there who are in the position, if you're looking in the mirror thinking, oh my God, am I Tommy Boy? If you kind of, if that's the path you took, yeah, you are. It doesn't mean that you're Tommy Boy, but hey, that's the path. And so hopefully you can become aware of it before, you know, your girlfriend leaves you and your dad dies and the company goes under and the park bench breaks. Because then you're smelling like pine, right? You're all pined up with air freshener perfume with Dan Aykroyd in the elevator. So, all right, now we're getting too far off the beaten path here.
No, it all applies, Jason. In fact, I think if you want to go with that analogy, you know, go one step further.
Let's do it.
To do. Sometimes we go a little too far, but, you know, again, a good question to ask is, if you are in Tommy Boy's position and that bench breaks, do you have people around you who are going to laugh at you and say, good for him? Or are they going to be there to help, again, say, you know, hey, here's a hand. Grab my hand, whether or not you're wearing your velvet glove or not, and pick you up. And we're going to help rebuild that bench so we can keep moving forward. Like, that's it, right? And it's, you know, it doesn't need to be this, you know, either feel-good story or this story of, you know, a bunch of bullies laughing at somebody. But that's what you want as a leader, right? You want people that are rowing in the same direction, if you will, to continue the boat analogy as well. And you don't want people that are, you know, hoping that a gust of wind sends you in another direction. And it all comes down to awareness, right? If you're aware of it, you could do something about it. But if you're not aware, you know, you're at the mercy of, you know, whatever way the wind is blowing, if you will, and it could carry you off in a direction that is, you know, is going to be difficult to recover from. So
you bring up a good point, though.
Is beating that enough to death?
No. You bring up a good point because, you know, you have to go a step further. This is a great. Oh man, this is so good because. A lot of times, you know, the velvet glove leader that comes in brings in a frat boy mentality or a sorority girl mentality with them, like Tommy Boy doing the bong hit going through the table, right? And he had to get over that side of him and allow a David Spade type of a personality into his life so much he would travel with him and sing love ballads with him, crying in the rain, in order to get to the next level of life. So, hey, this is a great little existential conversation we're having here this morning, because sometimes you have to shed the old life if you're a velvet glove person in order to have a new, you know, take off the glove, I guess. Sometimes you got to take the glove off to get a callus or two, and David Spade is a callus. And you don't always get a callus with a hammer. There we go. How's that for an analogy? I'm getting excited now.
It's nice, and I guess, and again, it brings us to two more directions we can go in, which is one, as far as, you know, sometimes needing to take that glove off. It comes down to adaptability, right? You know, you need to be able to adapt to the situation and to know that, yeah, there are times to maybe have, you know, it's tough to ever argue that you want some superficiality, but there are times to maybe be overly nice and go above and beyond, even if it's, you know, not your personality. And, you know, that's that other side of the velvet glove, right? And there are times to be the iron fist. And, you know, the leader who knows when to apply either or and to be aware of it, that's a leader that's going to succeed. And then the other piece of that is, You know, do you need a David Spade in your life? Do you need somebody that's there that, you know, sometimes it's just there watching you make a fool out of yourself, which, again, there's plenty of scenes of that. And sometimes it's there to actually interject something valuable. And I'm tempted, and, you know, everything within me is saying I probably shouldn't go down this direction, but you could argue that in some ways David Spade is there as a coach, right? He's there as a sidekick. You know, Tommy Boy is essentially still in charge. He's going to be the leader, but David Spade is there to, you know, maybe help identify ways that Tommy Boy can, you know, not make a fool out of himself, or the way that Tommy Boy can, you know, maybe improve his ability to actually sell things and be the leader of a company. And again, certainly an imperfect analogy, as many analogies are, but again, who in your life do you have as a sidekick? Who's there to be a callus, as you say? Who's there to be a hammer? And who's there to, you know, help you apply the brakes, if you will, and help you steer if the brake pads fail, which, of course, you know, Callahan auto part brakes never fail, but, you know, again. So that's my back to you on the analogy building there.
Well, that's okay, because as you were, you know, comparing yourself to David Spade, I thought, oh boy, that's a tough analogy, but at least you're there in support mode. I guess me.
I went with Joe Dirt, you know, well, the same name. So I that direction too.
I was thinking me being in the media, being part of that media pariah, you know, the jackals that we are in the media, I guess I'd be Rob Lowe in that movie. I'd be the guy always trying to bring you down and screw you over. And so hey man, if I'm not pissing you off, I'm not doing my job. That's what they always told us in school when you're in the media doing you know, investigative stuff. If you're not making them mad, you're not doing your job. So anyways, wow, this is quite the conversation. I enjoy this very much. You know, the other part of Velvet Glove, which is the iron fist that's masked with a velvet glove, if you will, we should almost bring that into another conversation as more of a, almost like a passive aggressive leader.
Yeah. And again, that takes its toll, right?
Yeah.
It's and there are leaders, I've encountered many who have that passive aggressive. Some are just passive and some are just aggressive. And some might say that at least if you have both, you're somewhat balanced. But that's not the definition of balance, right? It's not going from one extreme to the other. It's like we said before, it's a leader who can adapt, who can recognize that, you know, middle of the road sometimes is good.
But
you don't have to, you know, you don't have to allow yourself to be labeled as one or the other. And I see that far too often, Jason. It's
you know, another conversation I was having this morning before actually the one that I was having while you were texting me about if we were still doing this interview this morning, because of my new studio and moving and all the different stuff I've been going on in the last month. So I appreciate you being very flexible and nimble with me this morning. But it was actually a gentleman who's in Alcohol Anonymous. And we've got another public official that's gotten their third or fourth public incident with alcohol and all this other stuff. And so my phone gets off the hook when that kind of stuff happens, right? Oh, did you hear this and this and this? Because, you know, being in the media, but I don't cover that stuff. I don't care less. But I thought, you know, since it is a public official and it has been four or five times that this has been an issue, this is common in a lot of states. So this is my mind, you know, my podcast mind now, if you will. It used to be called my media mind, and now it's my podcast mind, because we've apparently developed silos within media, because you can't be a multimedia anymore. You got to do one specific thing. But sorry, being snarky. Was that I wonder how much, you know, alcoholism, enablement, that type of behavior is in companies. You know, using, you know, the public arrest or public, you know, the issues that happen with the politicians and the public officials and that sort of stuff. And, you know, you can look at it from a government agency because they have all kinds of different departments, man. They got, you know, departments to go and help, you know, with your social cause here and your addiction here and make sure you're not late for work here and all. Are they even doing that with their own employees? You know, so a conversation like that, I think, would be good, because how many companies out there aren't even utilizing their own people within their organization? Like, they're so busy promoting it that they have these types of tools. Are they even using it? And so I thought it'd be easy just to use the government because, you know, we pay for that. So that's an old trick we'd use in the media. Just grab somebody from the university or from the government and put them in the middle of the chaos. And so anyway, that way we don't have to point any fingers and we can advance the conversation that way. Does that make sense, Joe?
To bring in a universal enemy like the government when you're trying to make a point. So I certainly agree with that. In terms of, you know, companies or the government who, again, are maybe not doing what they're saying, or maybe put another way, because, and this is what I see a lot of, companies or governments who are inclined to spend a lot of money and time and energy adding on new tools and new resources instead of using what's at their disposal, which is basically what you just said, right? You know, they're not actually using what's there and what's available, which is, again, part of what I do coming in as a coach. I'm not coming in as some giant disruptive undertaking or new initiative. I'm coming in there to help you take advantage of your existing resources and to get the most out of them, again, instead of reinventing the wheel. So, yeah, everything you described absolutely makes sense. I think, again, it is more common from a government standpoint where you get complacent and where, again, the answer, of course, is always, what, more money, right? Another initiative, more money, some new approach, instead of actually just taking a step back and saying, well, hold on, believe it or not, we actually have some talent here. We actually have some experience. And if we make better use of that talent and experience, we're going to get a lot faster results. We're going to get a lot more sustainable results. And quite frankly, we're going to get a lot cheaper results than if we try to bring in some outside force and some new initiative that's going to last, you know, at best 2 years before we're moving on to the next one. So, thanks for the chance to hop on my own soapbox with that, Jason. That felt good.
Yeah, well, no problem there. But yeah, and this is, of course, previewing some of the next topic or topics that we're going to be talking about, because I do think the passive aggressive leader and, you know, almost the, I don't know if we call it the audit of the tools leadership, because as you were kind of talking, I was thinking, you know, a lot of companies have added daycare, and boy, look at the oil and gas world and the safety and compliance and this whole artificial intelligence wave that's coming. There's a lot of people that just need to take a step back. And this is not, you know, like today's the velvet glove Tommy Boy thing. You know, there was a little bit of finger pointing there, but it was mostly just the way people are born and the way that they were brought up. And so it wasn't meant to be specific finger pointing as much as the tools one is more meant to be hey, slow down and see what you got first, because that could bite you, actually. You know, like, all I could think of is, like, it was 10-15 years ago, one of our local city council members got a DUI, and their office was literally two doors down the hall from a recovery center. Like, you can't make that up. Like, a recovery center that they had been funding, essentially, and then it was two offices down in this office building from where the guy who got the DUI was. So, of course, the first question is, well, why doesn't he have his lunches there instead of the bar? You know, and so, you know, things like that. So, like, are you even using the tools you're funding? Like, what's, you know, because that sort of thing. And I think it just goes back to intention then. So I think a lot of people just need a little bit of a reset, because, quite honestly, people have been going pretty hard for the last 2 years trying to navigate through some of these waters. So anyways, let's talk about how people can get in touch with you and all kinds of different things before we start doing a whole new preview show. I feel like it's the half hour before you start a movie. We're doing previews of our next shows all of a sudden.
Well, that's okay. Well, I'm excited as always for future conversations with you, Jason. But for now, if anyone's looking for a one-off conversation with me, the easiest way, as always, would be either on LinkedIn or head on over to Witting Partners, WITTING Partners.com. And, you know, always happy to continue these types of conversations and to talk about, you know, specific situations that we've talked about today. Or sort of the third offer there is, of course, to just, you know, talk about classic movies like Tommy Boy and how they might be relevant within your life and some of the leadership challenges that you might be facing. So, again, always happy to have a conversation, whether it's with you, Jason, or with others who, again, are interested in this topic and who are, again, curious what they might be missing about how they are perceived by their stakeholders, and curious about the ways in which, again, they're leaving resources and they're leaving tools on the table that could help them move forward.
So every now and then on my radio program, I have to fill like 2 minutes because sometimes a person's question is, you know, too long of an answer, or I talk for four straight minutes when I can ask a three-word question, that type of stuff. So sometimes I'm looking for like a 2 to 3 minute kind of audio, if you will. So I'm just wondering if maybe under 3 minutes, you can describe to me what someone would expect if they were to engage with you, what the process might look like, and what some of the services are that you do. So, you know, if I were to say, you know, something like, Joe Sinnott of Whitting Partners, boy, leadership right now is going through a lot of changes. And as they go into next year, what can people do and what can people expect with Whitting Partners?
Well, when people reach out to me, and for anybody in the future that will reach out to me, what they can expect, and you know, the reason that they're coming to me in the first place, is an increase in their awareness as far as the limitations that they have as a leader and the opportunities. That's the impetus, right? They know that something is amiss, whether it's with them or whether it's with their stakeholders. Something is amiss and something is holding them back from sustained success. So that's the impetus. As far as what the process is, it starts with questions. And quite frankly, it continues with questions and it ends with questions. Questions from me to you to help uncover what it is that is driving some of these big challenges. Because typically, the challenges that people are facing are under the surface. They're not terribly obvious. So some of the core things that I do on a day-to-day basis are, one, these 360-degree conversations, which you'll find in any sort of leadership program, where I am talking with stakeholders, whether it's colleagues, whether it's family members, whether it's friends, whether it's coworkers, reports, bosses, whatever the case might be, to get their observations on what could be holding back an individual leader. That helps uncover way more than me just talking with you and getting your opinion on, again, where you think your opportunities lie and where your challenges lie. The other big piece of what I do is take people through this energy-focused program, this leadership development program, where we go through the five phases of the energy life cycle, which just so happens to mirror five phases of leadership development. And those phases should be familiar to anybody listening because they are the exploration phase, the development phase, the transportation phase, the production phase, and the distribution phase, the downstream phase. And all of those need to work together. You have to have an understanding of how they're all linked together in order to have a, you know, better awareness of, again, how you're contributing or not contributing to the mission of your company. And so, again, I take people through that. If it's in a large group, it tends to be a little bit more front and center, that program. And if it's just one-on-one, it tends to be more behind the scenes. And then going through that process, Jason, which is typically on the order of 12 months, people can expect to be able to make better decisions, faster decisions, more confident decisions, and to have other people see how much more effective they are as a leader. That's how I know that I'm doing my job, because other people are saying, wow, Jason Spies is night and day from where he was, or wow, he's much more effective at communicating his message than he was before. That's how I measure my results, which of course are the same as the results that the person I'm working with, and that's what anybody who reaches out to me can expect if they're interested in executive coaching that is focused on and built upon the oil and gas industry.
What's the website?
Whittingpartners.com, WITTING partners.com.